Welcome to Unknown Artist. I'm your host, That Nikki You Know, and today's guest is Honora.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Thanks for coming on the show. I'm so excited because I remember I saw you play at a small basement show recently, and like just before the holidays.
Yeah.
And it was so mind-blowing.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. That's really sweet.
And so I'm just really excited to have you on the show.
Well, thanks for having me. That was a really fun time with Nagme and other Mars, not this sound person Mars, different Mars. That was a really, really nice special way to end the year. I think that was my last show of the year, and it was really like just a beautiful moment. So
yeah, and both of them actually have been guests on the show as well.
Oh, that's sweet.
Yeah.
A little reunion, a little electronic sonic reunion.
Yeah.
So shall I play a song?
Yeah, absolutely. Please okay. Do. Mars, do you want to...
I've got tender feelings now.
yeah, what's coming up now? I mean, I feel like, full disclosure, I have daddy issues that I have definitely projected onto this song.
Definitely.
And I don't really know what it's about. That might be too personal.
All right, let's just dive in. Okay. Daddy. Okay. Okay. So my dad is a musician. He's a drummer. And he had this opportunity when he was probably around my age, actually, maybe a year or two older. I'm 25 now. He had just married my mom. They'd moved into a house and she found out she was pregnant with me. And he has a cousin who is a tour musician, has been a tour musician his whole life, playing in Asia, Middle East, Europe, all over, playing all these different instruments. And my dad, who's always admired him, had the opportunity to go. And my mom found out she was pregnant. And she said, like, go. Now is the time. Like, this is the time to do it. Go. Like, she'll be little, you know, she won't remember. You'll be back. It'll be fine. Mm-hmm. And he chose to stay. So there's been this lifetime of, I mean, he's been playing music, of course. He's been finding places for himself and he's very talented. But he didn't go, you know, he didn't go. And like, my whole motto now is, if the opportunity comes, you go, you know? And so now that I'm doing this and I'm doing original music, my own music that I write, in to the degree that I am now, is like, it's, he's played more gigs and with more people, but I've had more traditional looking success from it, we'll call it, I guess. Like, I'm making less money now than he was because of like economy, whatever. But yeah.
All musicians are making like no money.
No, like he oh my God, like he would get paid the same number amount in like bars and pubs playing like cover sets in the 80s, that the same number amount that I'm making now for the similar kinds of, it's crazy. But so that song, like, when I go to New Orleans, see a show that my daddy ain't seen, will all my childhood troubles surface? Will my ghost catch up to me? It's like, is this shit gonna carry on to me? What am I gonna, you know, how do I walk with this? Because it, of course, in many ways has affected how he perceived his own life, how he raised his two kids. I have a sister, and now I have choices every single day with what I do with this music. Now, as a musician, professional musician now, I realize that there's a lot of stuff that I carry with me through all these different spaces and different contexts. And I just want to like do so with gratitude and not just heaviness. So it's, you know, like, it's also my thank you song and my I love you song to the people that have supported me this far, and my musicians and friends and fans that have been, you know, so, so sweet to me while I've been turning my little traumas into songs, you know? So it's, partly it's, I have to have faith that his experience doesn't entirely dictate mine, but I'm also not completely isolated from what he lived through either. So it's just trying to come to terms with that and be a healthy, happy, whole person doing music. And that's not as easy or simple as it sounds.
No, not at all. And especially like, first of all, let's just acknowledge there is no little trauma. Don't diminish yourself and your experiences like
for
that.
For sure. Yeah.
Because that's what really, I wouldn't say it defines us, but it gives us a big starting point.
Yeah.
Especially like musicians and artists in general who usually use their emotions to like fuel their work.
Yeah, absolutely. And in a really literal sense, that was the case for me, because I'm very open about this. I was sexually assaulted by an ex-boyfriend when I was 18. Holy shit. This is a weird club we're part of, but like, we're, like that Joni Mitchell song, by the time I got to Woodstock, we were 500,000 strong. Anyway. Hashtag me too. So,
yeah. It's a common story.
It is. But from that, like, obviously that destroyed my life and it was the darkest place I've ever been after that. And, but at a certain point in like years and years of misery, it felt like years and years, it was probably 3 years or something like that. One day I woke up miserable as ever, angry as ever, hating myself, hating everyone else, thinking the world was out to get me and I was a victim. And then I was like, you know what? Like, it's not fair that this person gets off scot-free and I just have to carry this stupid heavy thing that I didn't ask for the rest of my life. So that day, it was probably around 2015, I said, screw it. I'm going to write songs. I'm going to write poems. I'm going to turn this into something and play music. It was always in me. I've always sung like this. So it's like, what am I doing just wasting away in my mom's basement? You know, I have to do something with it. Mm-hmm. So in a very literal sense, those traumas, big and small, all different types and corners of life experience, literally are in the lyrics. So it's been like a real journey trying to find ways to do that without being totally depresso.
Yeah, it's
all the time.
It's definitely a journey. Like from the perspective of having written a bunch of songs about my trauma and performed them like hundreds of times.
Oh my God, it's powerful. Huh?
It's powerful. It's difficult, and it's really rewarding.
Yeah, it's validating.
And it helps you move forward and through those things to the a point where then you can help other people to move forward and through those things.
Yeah, that was this case for me. Once I realized I was strong enough to talk, to speak for myself. I mean, I read a lot of blogs from other survivors, a lot of testimonies from other survivors, and that gave me so much strength that I realized I can be that similar source of strength and hold space for others in my way, whether they're just listening to my song or messaging me on Instagram to say they felt something or coming up to me after a show with tears in their eyes to say that they lived through the same thing. Like, that's like why we do this, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Totally. And it also helps that you have like all of the technical skills to like, back that up. Like your range is crazy.
Oh, thank you very much. That comes from like a very lonely teenagehood singing in the stairwell in my house, in my mom's house.
Hey, stairwells are like one of the best places, like next to bathrooms. They're like the best places.
Yeah, they foster all the angst and creativity you could need.
Absolutely. Yeah. Do you ever like go back? Because so when I was a kid, I very like openly sang like, you know, all the time, very loudly.
Same. And my sister hates it.
Yeah. But I didn't like, because I grew up in the woods as well. So like it didn't occur to me that other people could hear me. And I don't know if you had that experience of like being in a stairwell, you feel very secluded and you feel like no one can hear you.
The sound kind of wraps you up too.
It really does. Like you forget about the whole world. And then like sometimes later you'll be like, oh yeah, everyone definitely heard that.
Yeah, for sure. It kind of happens for me like that on stage still. Like when I really get into a song and go inside myself, it's kind of like I'm in me and I'm also in the crowd watching me with everybody else. It's the oddest thing. And it feels like a dream until I'm finished. And then I'm like, oh, that really happened. And then I'm like me again and not the artist. And it's such a weird thing to bounce between those two spaces. Yeah.
Absolutely. Do you ever, so this has happened to me a couple times and I just personally want to know that other people have experienced.
Yeah, tell me,
this.
What is it?
I'll get so wrapped up in like that sort of almost dissociative space.
Yeah. Yeah.
That like sometimes I will forget that I'm actually singing and performing and I'll stop.
Oh, you stop.
Like singing. Like I'll keep playing because it's kind of automatic, but sometimes I'll just like forget what I'm doing completely.
Okay. Like context goes out the window and you're just kind of like in your body.
Yeah.
I've never stopped. That's one thing I don't think I've ever done. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I'll have a word blank and muscle memory saves me, but like I've never had that. That's interesting.
It's rare and it usually happens when I'm super depressed.
Oh no.
Shit. But you know, that's, you know, trauma.
Yeah. Well, now I know what to look out for so I can check in.
Yeah. And from the other side, if it ever happens to you, it usually is totally fine. And most people either don't notice or if they do notice, it's like a way of connecting and feeling more, feeling your humanity a little bit more. I think.
I agree. I think it's like, I think seeing like the fallibility of such a strong person and performer on stage is like makes them seem even better. Like, I don't know, it makes you relate to them more, I think, and feel that their songs come from somewhere and that it's not just about whatever it is that people think the job of music is about, you know?
Yeah, like earlier today I saw like a Billie Eilish acoustic performance, and like the first song she ends it on like this really high note and her voice just like cracks. She's like, oh no.
Oh, yeah,
but it was like the last note of the whole song. She's like, oh, okay, good night.
That's, but like, I love that.
We know that she's great, right? So she doesn't have to prove that to us.
No. But that's like, you get a little insight into her character and like the fact that she's still like 18 years old, which is like baby, you know?
Absolutely.
And that's beautiful. Yeah, it's nice that she can lend herself to those little accidents and not freak out and start it all over, delete everything. It's like, oh, I'm a person singing a song, you know?
Yeah. Accidents happen and
they
can be really nice.
Yeah, they can.
Something strange happened today. The man in a red truck called out to me and he sped away. I was walking across the boulevard to the public pool. Halfway through year one of my middle school. talk of love.
So more on Paul. Yeah, I don't know. Like, so you asked about what it's like playing with him and falling in love with the person you're playing with. And he's just always been the kind of person that I've known him to be very kind of quiet, introspective, and sort of in his head a lot of the time, which means that you can't always get a read on what's going on with him. And as a musician, that kind of like worried me, because like if he, and also he doesn't tend to keep a phone. And so when a person isn't genuinely communicative and there's like a rehearsal or a show and he's like, he used to be late a lot, and I'm like anxiety on 3 million because like every show was the Bell Center in my head, which I mean, anyway, we had a residency at Honey Martin's and I would go like 2 hours early with my little dress and makeup sitting there waiting for the band to get there with like a glass of lemon water. Anyway.
Can relate. Yes.
Yeah. But it was really nice. Like we built so many beautiful memories with our band playing at Honey's and like kind of developing our rapport and our sound and all these other little shows that we played with other bands, you know, around in the venues everyone plays in, like Casa, places like that. And then little festivals started happening, and I was also on La Voix.
Yeah, tell me about that.
That was like all that was 2017. La Voix, falling in love with Paul, moving in with him was like that year, and also getting a record contract.
That's a huge year.
It was every other year is a huge year. 2019 was like crazy tour year, and like that was crazy. That was seriously like, I don't
even. Where did you tour?
I did a cross Canada tour opening for Cœur de Pirate. And then I did an American tour. I toured Quebec, toured Ontario. Like, I don't
just
even
tour,
know.
Tour, tour.
Yeah. We released an EP that year. So that was like the year of crazy, you know?
Yeah.
So every other year, the odd numbers seem to be nuts. Also the five. So we'll see how 2020 goes. But La Voix was really cool because, I mean, there's always people that go into singing competitions expecting it to create a career for them. But at the time, like, I was playing in little pubs, like, with my band boyfriends, family guys. And my mom said, like, the year's going to pass anyway. You may as well put yourself in front of 3 million people. Like, they're going to take you. What do you have to lose, kind of thing? So I was like, okay. I had reservations. You know, it's like, I'm Anglophone, I'm brown girl. Like, what's going to happen when I go? Are they going to like it? Who cares? But I just went and did it just to see what would happen. And they liked it. They liked what I was doing. Although their first performance was at like the blind auditions, they pre-taped it, and it was like 4 a.m. our call time, and I was one of the day. So like
4 a.m.
Four in the morning. So like
you have to sing at 4 a.m.
Like the interview started at 4, and I think I sang at 6. I know, and I'm pretty sure I screamed my way through that whole thing just to get the notes out because I was also terrified.
Yeah.
Like, don't think about it, don't think about it. But I ended up just kind of like screaming through, which wasn't great, but they turned around, and then after that I did okay. But I went in there kind of expecting it to just be like, you go, you sing, what happens, happens, just make friends. But there was, the other people went in there a lot more seriously than that, expecting to become the next like Eric Lapointe. I remember one kid, I probably shouldn't tell this story, but I don't even, whatever. There was one younger participant who got on the show, and once he got accepted from the blind auditions, he broke up with his girlfriend and cut out all his friends, saying that, I'm going to be a big star, I don't need you.
Whoa.
And then he got eliminated the next round. And then had to go crawling back and beg them to be in his life again.
Oh my God.
So like that is not the attitude to go into it with. It's just a stepping stone like anything else. It's an opportunity like anything else.
Yeah, you know? I remember I actually auditioned for Canadian Idol.
You did?
When I was 17.
Oh my gosh.
It was a terrible experience. I went to the Saint-Laurent Shopping Center in Ottawa.
Oh my goodness.
And there was a lineup that was several hours.
Wow.
To like get to the place where then you could wait a few more hours.
Oh my God.
To do your first audition and then wait like a few more hours to do your second. And if you even got that far.
Yeah.
And then if you made it through the second one, then you could go on TV.
Okay.
So it was just like, so, like then and then and then and then.
Yeah.
So I was like super nervous. I was 17 and like had like no experience. Like I think I had been in like one talent show.
Yeah, but like a 9-hour wait before a performance is, when you're nervous and in a room full of thousands of strangers, is not the way to.
Yeah.
That's a terrible condition. Like, that's the worst conditions to do well. Oh my
yeah,
God.
Yeah, and like, I was also really into like older, like 40s music.
Yeah.
And so I remember singing Heaven. And
heaven, I'm in heaven. I love that song.
I do too. And the judges were not so impressed. They were like, you sound great, but like, why the show tunes? Do something more pop. And so then I like tried, I was like, what do I know that's pop?
What did you sing?
I ended up singing like Christina Aguilera.
Which Beautiful?
God, I don't even remember.
What year was that? Do you remember?
God, I was 17. I was born in 88.
That's Paul. Paul's the same year. He was an 88 baby too. So that would have been like 2006, five or six.
Yeah.
Okay. Maybe something from the Back to Basics album.
I think 2005. I think it was from like Genie in a Bottle.
Oh,
like
that
era.
Phase. Okay.
Like,
okay.
Yeah. And it was like, I did it terribly because I was just like trying to figure it out, and I didn't even have like a phone, so I couldn't even
lyrics. Shit.
I couldn't even. I had to just remember.
Oh my God! No. Worst nightmare. What?
It was terrible. And so you know, I finally make it to the second audition, and you know, then I'm in front of the producers of the show, and I do like this terrible Christina Aguilera song. And they were just like, you seem uncomfortable. I was like, well, this isn't what I practiced.
Yeah. Did you tell them that?
I did. And they asked me to do what I had practiced. And for some reason, I had it in my head that I had to do a different song than what I did before.
Oh, no.
I don't know why. I put weird pressures and weird restrictions on myself
sometimes.
I feel
that so much. Yeah.
So I ended up singing Fever.
Oh, that's a cool song, though.
Yeah, but I think like because of the way that the day had gone, and I also hadn't eaten like that whole day because you couldn't leave. Like if you left, you lost your spot.
Oh my God!
So I couldn't eat, and didn't eat because I didn't anticipate it would take so long. Like I'd never done anything
that's
like
crazy.
This.
That's crazy. Yeah, that's really the worst situation to thrive in.
So I did a bad job, and then they told me that I could come. They were like, "You sound great." But you have acne, so like clear that up and come back.
Are you serious?
Yeah. Yeah. So they wouldn't take me because I have bad skin.
What the heck? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That is the weirdest thing.
Yeah. They're we're not putting you on TV.
What?
Yeah. So I was super pissed and I was
wow, that's
never
really,
coming
really,
back here again.
Really crappy.
So then like I come to Montreal and you're actually, I think, the third person I know who's been on La Voix. And because of that experience with Canadian Idol, mm-hmm. I'm just like, oh God, I don't want to do something like that again. I don't want them to tell me that I'm like some weird thing that has nothing to do with my singing.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I just don't want to. I guess I just don't want to open myself up to that like weird level of criticism.
You know what? I don't blame you because it's a lot of pressure and it's really stressful and you start to hyperanalyze all these little details about yourself. And I got like a weird tick of like obsessively trying to like pop blackheads even though they weren't there. Like, and my skin was a mess from stress and from doing that. So I had these like blotches and I was putting on tons of makeup. You're probably healthier not doing that. Not that people were mean or anything, like no one ever said anything, but there was one almost, you know, with my hair, because I have like textured hair, and I held my breath. Like one of the ladies that was doing hairstyling was like, so what do we do about her hair? And I was like, oh, don't straighten it. I'm not going to let you straighten it. And the other one went, oh, well, I think it's part of her look. And I like breathed a sigh of relief because like 5 years ago, that conversation probably would have gone differently. And in my life, it's gone differently in the past too, where it's like, I have to justify not straightening my hair when it's just naturally what grows out of my head. And it's like, I'm not going to be whiter for you. Sorry. Like,
yeah.
You know, just be honest and say you don't like brown people and just put white people on your show, but don't try to whitewash me. You know what I mean? But like, I can never say that to them, to their faces like that, and, you know, but she was cool. It was all right. But
I'm glad that it was all right.
But it was like right on that line, and I looked at her and she looked at me and she went, I think it's part of her look. And I was like, thank you. I don't know her name. Redhead hairdresser lady. Thank you. That was important to me.
But it was like a huge amount of pressure. Like you're a bit younger than me, but I remember like we're not too far apart. Mm-hmm. And growing up, I remember like I had very curly hair. It's much less big than it was in the past, largely because, you know, I don't wash as much and I brush it. And I do like curly girl method. And
It's chill, right?
It's great.
It's cool.
But yeah, like at the time when I was just like over washing my hair and it was really dry and then like it also huge. And it was just like a nightmare. I got like bullied mercilessly for that.
Oh, same. All the time. I had this, Robbie, if you're out there. Okay, I'm naming names. Robbie and Steven.
Is this a bully? Please tell me.
Of course it's a bully.
Good.
He drew a picture. Like, so he used to draw like caricatures, and this is really like crappy. Like of me diving into a tub of hair gel, or like me getting like a gigantic curly pubes clipped off with shears, or like a gorilla having sex with me because I was like a monkey because of the curly. Crazy. Like Robbie, if you're out there, like eat a bag of dicks. Just saying. Like that really messed with my self-esteem and my self-image. When you're like the only one in this, I wasn't the only person with textured hair in the school, but I was the only one in my class. There weren't that many of us, maybe like two or three per grade with like any kind of African ancestry. Mm-hmm. So it was like, yeah, you're an easy target. So I feel that big time.
Yeah. Like I grew up in a small town.
Yeah. Oh my God.
And so it was like 6,000 people. There was like one black kid, and I think he might have been adopted into a white family.
Like my dad.
Yeah. So like there was like those poor kids. There was like him and like one other brown kid.
Oh my God.
And everyone else was like the white, like so white that it was like, you're not Irish. Like they were like
that kind of white. Oh my.
Like they would be particular about like what kind of white you are.
Oh, that's ridiculous. And like they're running out of things to discriminate for.
And so like my dad is like part Latin, and he was also like Francophone, and like born into, well, he grew up, he was adopted, but he grew up in like a French family. So like our family was, I wouldn't say totally bilingual, because being in an Anglophone area, we talked mostly English
for sure.
But I definitely was bullied for being the French kid.
That's so silly.
And like, just like all the weird, like,
why would you pick on that? Leave it alone.
Yeah. Like, I guess there was just like this innate, like need to just find any slight difference and to ostracize him like mercilessly. I don't get it. And no. I hated it.
And like now looking back, you're just like a normal kid. And like, why was there anything to pick on at all? Right.
Right.
It makes no sense.
It doesn't. And it's bullies suck.
Bullies absolutely suck.
Deal with your problems.
Deal with your issues, your insecurities. Leave us alone.
Yeah, like I really wish that there was a lot more like emotional education in school.
I agree 100%.
And also at home. I think like generally there's been so much like intergenerational trauma that just we need to heal just as a world.
Big
we need
time.
To heal.
I fully agree. Oh my gosh. On healing, can I play you a song?
Absolutely.
Okay. So this one I wrote when I was having a little bit of a mental health relapse right after I signed with the record label, Dare to Care. It's like, okay, it's real now. La Voix is finished. I signed this contract and now I'm in this weird paranoia phase for no reason really. Mm-hmm. But, anyway, there I was, like, feeling all these weird things. And, like, I was just, like, in the bath, listening to, what's her name? Sylvia Plath audiobooks, which is a terrible thing to do when you're depressed and, like, feeling funny about the world. But, like, I would just sit in the bath for, like, 2 hours, like, before going to work and, like, listen to these depressing... But at that time when I realized, like, okay, I'm not in the clear, all the work that I did following trauma is not permanent. It can undo as quick, like, as... double, like twice as fast as you do it. And I realized that like that year, those years that I had spent doing all that hard work and having those beautiful experiences, I needed to maintain the healthy headspace that I developed. So I wrote this song called Skeletons, and it's about keeping your finger on it so you don't, you know, lose it. Just seems so hard.
afraid I'll be misunderstood, 'cause I am not perfect. I never meant to be. I'm just trying to learn to love all the broken parts of me.
I find it's really funny how, well, not maybe not funny, but I wonder if there's like an adaptive thing about like when you're feeling really down about adding to that, to like, you know, like you cycle farther and farther down.
Yeah.
Part of me wonders, because I know that for me, my part of my trauma response is dissociation.
Same.
And so like for me, it's really hard for me to actually react to how I'm feeling.
And like notice it, that it's as bad as it is. And
exactly. So I think like sometimes when I'm feeling kind of shit, I like make myself feel worse through like the media that I consume to kind
Same.
Of bring on the tears.
That's literally a lifelong pattern of mine, like going back at least a decade. Yeah.
But like tears themselves are actually very healing.
They are. Yes. The endorphins and all that. Yeah. And relief. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's super adaptive.
Yeah. But I don't know. I can't help but feeling that part of that phenomenon you're describing is a little bit of a self-destructive streak in myself anyway, manifesting. Like, even though I know there's good people close to me, like what in the song, like I have a hard time trusting that I'll be able to justify my feelings, I think, and like know how to explain what it is that I need is the main thing. And so I just kind of like stay in the bath instead of going like, hey mom, I'm not doing great. Like, can I come over and like have dinner? Instead of doing that, I'll just like spend 2 weeks in the bath and like answer everyone's messages super like not at all, you know, which makes no sense. Cause like I know better and I've been better, but when I'm in it, I don't think it's as bad as it is. So I just don't respond to it. And then I get worse. I don't know if that's like,
oh yeah, no, okay. This is very much resounding. Okay. Yes.
Yeah. When the assault stuff happened, like it took me a while to tell anybody, it's often the case. And when I first told some of the people that were closer to me at the time, their reaction was like, well, what did you expect to happen? And like, well, you went over there. And it's like, I went over there to get a plastic bag with my clothes in it, like not to get assaulted, you know? But like, there was a lot of like blaming language and, oh, that happens to everybody. And oh, you shouldn't have gone there and all this stuff. And it's like, in the beginning, it was really, really hard to come to terms with what happened because I didn't have that. And I ended up finding that kind of community or that support, like I said earlier, in reading blogs from like different feminist blogs and different testimonies from other people who survived rape as well. And like, that was like, oh, it's a pattern. It's not isolated. This isn't a freak accident. This is like a cultural, a social problem of like entitlement and misplaced emotions and lack of support. And like, what do we do with psychopaths? What do we do with narcissists? What do we do with them? Like, where do they go? You know, because they're out here making messes and hurting people. And that was just in my own case anyway. And so, and then later, like once I found my power and realized that it was a very, you know, cathartic and, like I said, powerful thing to say, hey, this happened to me and it wasn't okay. And if it happened to you, it wasn't okay. And it wasn't your fault. And you didn't deserve it. Once I found the power in that and started getting like a positive response from that, then the people around me started to be like, oh, now I see what you mean. I'm sorry I wasn't there. And like, they had to learn what isn't okay for themselves too, in order to help me. Cause like, you know, our moms who have been like tapped on the butt at their first office jobs in the 70s and 80s didn't have that space then. So they just kind of learned to swallow it and accept it as part of life. So they didn't know how to be there for us. My mom, I'm speaking from people around me anyway. So now she had to go through that education to learn what's okay and not okay for her in order to say what's not okay for me.
Yeah. And also I think there is a tendency when you've gone through trauma and survived it despite all the circumstances, and you've had to dig deep, you've had to work on like how you're dealing with it, and you know it's not been beneficial for you, and you've had to be like strong and not able to
silent,
to break
really.
down,
yeah,
then you also tend to take on this idea that like if you didn't have that benefit,
then why should anyone else?
Yeah. And like a lot of people feel like they're helping by forcing like
someone to suffer
because they think that it's made them better because that's what they've had to tell themselves in order to get through it,
but they're not actually better for it. They
it would be better if none of that happened.
Yeah, it really would. Like thinking to that specific part about like, well, it made me better. Like that's the only option you have to think about it. Cause if you really think about the damage that was caused to you and how everyone around you let it happen, like how do you trust anyone ever again? I think you're right. I think it's a survival thing of like, oh no, I'm definitely better for having done that. Cause then you don't have to question the 20 years of like sadness.
So for that reason, I'm understanding though disappointed by like that kind of a reaction. And yeah, like similarly, like when I was, you know, raped in high school, it took me a long time to even like have the words to say that.
Same,
like it took like telling what happened to a friend and they were like, you were raped.
Yeah.
And I was
Oh yeah.
Oh
yeah. Oh,
like, because at the time I also was like, well, he was my boyfriend.
Yeah.
So like we were having consensual sex before.
Yeah.
And so in my mind, I was like, he can't rape me because also legally it hadn't been that long that was like actually,
that's crazy,
you know like that was something that changed in like what, the late 80s
90s I think
90s
marital rape was made illegal in the 90s. But no, I was similar for me. It's like there's an assumption that like possession of your body is legitimate and that it's constant and with the language that we use about this. But no, obviously consenting one time does not mean consenting every time at all times whenever the other person says, need to say that out loud just to like undo that, because it's in my head too from way back. So I need to say it out loud just to like debrief from that old thinking, you know.
And there's like a huge amount of like abuse that happens leading up to that,
of course,
oftentimes.
That,
like,
you don't notice because he loves me. He's just protective. He just, absolutely, he just loves me so much that he has to know where I am all the time. He has to, mm-hmm, touch me all the time. Yeah.
Especially if you like grew up in a situation that, like, if your family didn't model particularly positive, mm-hmm, relationships, which very few families model that.
Yeah. Because you have no frame of reference. Yeah.
Yeah. You have no frame of reference and you just kind of assume a lot of things based off of like movies and, yeah, TV, which are also hugely like unhealthy relationships.
Yeah. And also looking for an escape maybe from some dysfunction at home. So you just look to spend more time anywhere. And if for some people it's drugs, for some people it's a boyfriend and whatever it's going to be. And if it's a bad boyfriend, then, you know, here we are.
Yeah. Yeah. And so like for me, when I was going through that, mm-hmm, I had like one or two friends who were kind of there,
loop, yeah,
more or less. But like for the most part, I had been really ostracized from my friend group because that's part of the behavior to,
oh,
like,
yeah,
isolate you.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Same. Yeah. I lost, yeah, all my friends from that time.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Me too.
It's fucked up. Now, I don't know about you, like now maybe it's part of the like perception of success thing. Like a few of them have trickled back and like and comment on my like Instagram posts and stuff. And I've seen one or two people here and there since then, but like you always think about like, could I go back? And it's not about that. It's about who you become after and stuff. Mm-hmm. But that loss, the volume and like scope of loss that happens after something like that is like so hard to explain to someone who hasn't gone through it. And it's like, I still grieve and I still mourn sometimes the things like that of like these like really nice friendships that I had that are just, that got fizzled out completely because I was like too sick to maintain them or because there wasn't a belief there or because they were master manipulators and could tell everybody that I was crazy, you know, mm-hmm, whatever it was.
Also, like we were all adolescents, you know, like at that time, you know, it, for a lot of people, it takes incredible amount of time to like, you know, become a fully, you know, developed emotional human.
Yeah.
And even like not everyone gets there. Right.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
like it's
the worst
so
time
tricky
for it to happen. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I just rolled my eyes. You can't see it, but I just went, I rolled my eyes. Yeah.
It was felt.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm glad we can, yeah, talk about it here like this. Cause like sometimes like personally, like I've done a lot of interviews this year with the record that came out and everything. And like sometimes someone will be like, so there's this thing in your music where you talk about like, and I'll be like, are you talking about rape? And they're like, yes, I didn't know how to bring it up. I'm like, it's cool. And then sometimes the person glosses over it entirely and they'll go like, so you talk about consent a lot. So tell me about the song. And I'm like we're afraid.
But like Harry Potter and Voldemort, you know?
You know? But I'm glad that we can sit here and be like, here's what happened. And
yeah,
even now I'm having a hard time saying it because it's like, I also don't want to think about it all the time, you know?
Yeah.
And I don't want to be defined by that one experience in my music either. And it's not like Skeletons is more human than that, I think, and New Orleans too, but I don't know.
But yeah, there's not often a lot of spaces for us to be able to talk about that.
Yeah.
And we need to.
Yeah.
Like if you've like, that's one of the biggest parts of healing as someone who's like lived through trauma is sharing, yeah, your trauma.
Absolutely. I don't know where I would be today without the internet for that reason.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I seriously don't know. Like I think to the older women that I know that have been through the same thing and like a lot of their behaviors now make a lot of sense is all, you know. And I wonder where I would be if it weren't for that, like, validating voice saying, this was not okay, this was screwed up, this is why it's happening, or some of the reasons it's happening. We don't know what to do to stop it, but you didn't deserve that to happen to you. That, mm-hmm, was, like, the first, that was the day where I was able to let in good things, and that's when I started to believe that a happier life was possible for me, and that I deserved better than misery. And then I started writing songs, and then I started going up to strangers I didn't know and asking them to play with me. And like, there's no way that I would have had the confidence or like whatever strength it took to approach a stranger to ask them to play with me, you know, right in the thick of it. You know, you're so like, I was afraid to leave the house. You know, I had bleached all my hair and dyed it purple because I was so mad and like didn't know what to do. And
oh my God, the amount of times that I've changed my hair because it's like
panic,
you know, because you want to be able to control something.
That's exactly.
And you feel
it, yeah,
like everything else is so out of your control. So yeah, at least you can like dye your hair pink or whatever.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. She looked down at the ends of her hair. But yeah, but that's, it's cool though. Cause it's nice to see progression though. It's nice to see growth. Like you're not the same person as when you were 17 and that happened.
Oh God, no.
I'm not the same person as when I was 18 and that happened. And now I can go up to strangers and be like, hey, you play really well. Would you like to play with me? Like that was like such a huge, from the person I was before that, this like sad, scared, angry little husk of a lady or whatever, like to this, I like to think of like this happy, joyful person that could like express positive feelings and not just crappy things is like a real gift. And I don't think I would have had that if it weren't for that aha moment. And for me, it came from the internet. But
yeah, but also, yeah, that sense of like in skeletons, getting your skeletons out, you know, like you have to get it out before you can kind
take
of
in
feel
good stuff. Yeah.
Good again and grow and have space for things.
Absolutely.
So, yeah. I applaud you for getting it all out.
Thank you.
Having the courage to do that.
Thank you. Yeah. It's just one of those days. It was like sometimes you sit down to write a song on purpose, like the other one before that, Talk of Love. And then sometimes you're just like something's buzzing in your head and you're like pacing and then you're like, oh, I got to get it out. So I sat down at the piano and I was like, B chord, B7. And then I went for it. And then it came out in one sitting, like 15 or 20 minutes. And the story was there and it was done. Like that was the song over, you know? And
absolutely.
That's when that started happening, and it wasn't like these obscure dark lyrics that nobody understood, but when I was able to write about the feelings in a really clear way that followed an arc, and like I knew people could relate to some of the little things that I was talking about, and like can you blame my apprehension, I'm afraid I'll be misunderstood, like who hasn't felt afraid to confess their deepest darkest fears to somebody, you know? And when I realized that I really did have the power to harness those feelings and turn them into something universal, I was like, okay, imposter syndrome, take a back seat. We're here for the long haul. I am doing this now. You know, even if it's not the best song in the history of humankind, like it's one of my most successful ones so far in terms of craft lyrically. Not released yet, but I'm going to fight tooth and nail for it to be on the next album.
Good. Yeah, yeah. I hope.
Girl, I'm calling. The phone, I've got something to say. Money man, don't buy, you haven't been well. Get on up there and play. 'Cause
Unknown Artist is recorded at The Library and hosted on godbird.com. Please check out our Patreon. Spread the news, spread the love.